So I'd like to start my talk this evening by saying actually I have no particular qualifications to be sitting here in this spot other than the fact that I met the Dharma some 30 years ago, and I'm not sure whether I should really say how long, because then maybe you have some expectation that I might know something. But probably my main qualifications are that I've been around for a while, I've got many grey hairs and I have to wear eyeglasses. But I've been very privileged, I guess, to have had many opportunities to come to the Dharma in a number of ways. My meeting with the Dharma, Buddha Dharma, was in England, and I happened to meet two Tibetan Lamas, Lama Thupten Yeshe and Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who it turned out were actually my root teachers, so I kind of got it right first up. I think that was very fortunate. I meet many people who have been looking for their teacher for a very long time and maybe are still looking, so that was a great blessing. And then I came back to Australia, and in the 70s, the Buddhist Society actually was the only centre here in Perth, and they were in a little house somewhere in North Perth. I can't remember the name of the street now. And I paid a visit and was delighted to find that at least there was something Buddhist here in Western Australia. So I then went on to the southwest, where I settled with my husband and then young family, two children. And I had the thought that maybe to bring some nuns and monks to the area, and just to see if there was any interest in the Dharma. And to my delight, there was. So Hospice of Mother Tara was born, and I was the founding director. I did that for 12 and a half years, and then I thought I'd have a holiday. I thought, I'll have some time out. And I had about 7 months off, and then I was asked if I would be the SPC, the Spiritual Program Coordinator. So back in I came, and I've been doing that now for 5 years. And I enjoy that role very much. It's looking after the spiritual program of the hospice. And just to briefly mention that it's in Bunbury, 2 hours south of Perth, and has a range of activities. Basically, we think of ourselves as being a hospice for the mind. So we don't go out sort of doing the palliative care work. Many other organizations are already doing that very well. Our main focus is to help people deal with their death by ways of education, how to prepare for death and supporting them in doing that, and then also in being able to die peacefully. So that's our main focus. We also have yoga classes and meditation classes and regular Buddhist teachings. So there's quite a few different activities. I have also spent quite a lot of time with people with life-threatening illnesses, both sort of just experiencing them and then also in the dying process. And I've done a number of years of work in the local Bunbury Regional Prison, teaching yoga and meditation and some introductory Buddhist classes. So that's kind of a little bit about my own background. So I thought tonight to maybe not focus on death, maybe I've done death to death, and decided to call this evening's talk Integrating Dharma into Everyday Life, because I thought, well, what else can I really talk about that perhaps I know a little bit about? And I thought, well, it's really after many years of sitting on the cushion and taking teachings from various masters, what has been the most important? And it was really then trying to take whatever happened on the cushion into the everyday life. And I don't know about you people, but I have personally found that to be one of the most challenging parts. It can be so inspiring sitting in front of the teachers and the nuns and the monks and those people who really have, you know, some realizations. But somehow when you go back to your own kitchen sink, many things seem to come that really test you, and it's not always the Dharma that it being the first thing that comes to the mind in my experience. What I have come to observe is that all beings, and I guess we can certainly relate to humans and animals, basically having the same wish or search in life, and that is to be happy. So I haven't met anybody here in my journey that really sincerely says, you know, they wake up in the morning and think, well, I hope I have a rotten day today. I hope everything goes wrong. I hope I have more and more problems. It's quite the opposite. We all think, well, I hope I have a good day today, and I hope tomorrow is even better. So we, you know, at some level, we're all looking for happiness. And so with Buddhism, I think it's very much, has so much to offer in terms of being a way of life. I mean, of course, we know, I guess most of you have some exposure, I'm not too sure of your backgrounds, but that Buddhism is, of course, classified as a world religion. But I think it's very unique in that it's both a philosophy and a psychology, and really empowers us when we can take the teachings deep into our hearts, into our bones, you know, off the paper, off the text, and away from the teachers, but into our own hearts, to really empower us to become our own therapist, to really come to know our own mind and to know how to work with our mind, having a range of antidotes and methods to do that. And the Buddha's sole purpose for giving the teachings, starting out with the Four Noble Truths, was to provide beings with a framework of methods, medicine, antidotes, to actually eliminate suffering, ripen their full potential and experience lasting happiness. So I guess coming back to if that's what we're all looking for, it is all there in the Buddha Dharma if that is a path that you personally connect with and wish to study. And of course we need to do the studies first. We need to know how to think, how to meditate, and then to be able to actually put it into practice. And there's no better place than the field of life. That's where we really try it on and see, you know, how it fits and does it really work. You know, one of my teachers, Lama Thupten Yeshe, had this saying so often during the teachings, check up, check up, check up. He was always saying check up. Don't just believe it because the Buddha said, and don't just believe it because I'm saying it. Hear it, try it on. So, you know, we would go into a shop to buy some clothes and see, does it fit? You know, how does it look? And does it make sense? You know, does it work for you like that in your life? So really encouraging our own critical analysis, using our own intelligence to really discover for ourselves the validity of the teachings, or the non-validity, if that's the case. So it all depends on our mind and how we can process it. So Buddhism is not a path just to palliate suffering. I mean, there are many, many, many ways to palliate various kinds of pain. The heart of Buddhism is to really eliminate all suffering, to go to the very root of suffering, to know what the root of suffering is, and then to be able to eliminate it at the root. We all know if we just keep palliating or trimming the weeds off at the ground level, they still keep popping up again. So that's what happens in our life until we can actually pull out the real causes, the roots. So it provides a very practical approach to life. It's meant to be integrated. It's not something that we just do when we go to the temple, maybe when we come to Dhammaloka on a Friday night or whenever we come, or when we see a Buddha image, or perhaps we go to Asia and we visit many, many temples, very beautiful and lovely to be in. But this is not the real practice of Dharma. Now, the real practice of Dharma is really, how do we live our life? What are we doing in our everyday life? You know, we can come and we can hear teachings, we can have a nice meditation, it's very nice to sit quietly and in a still and such a supportive environment. But then what happens when we go back into our life? That is the key. That's what we really need to address. So firstly, just to say a little bit about the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. I personally really connect with the analogy of the Buddha being like the doctor, the Dharma being like the medicine, and the Sangha being like the nurse, helpers. So I often say at Hospice of Mother Tara, it's like you've come into the Buddha's waiting room and you've come to see the most special doctor, the one that has all of the qualifications, the one that won't let you down, the one that won't just give you 5 minutes and send you off with a script, will give you exactly what you need. But then, of course, it's up to us to take the medicine. So this, of course, is based on, you know, a whole lot more teachings and study to really discover for ourselves that the Buddha's teachings are valid and are authentic and will actually bring about the result that they say they will. But when we have some level of faith, some connection with the path, then we can really view the Buddha as being like the most esteemed doctor, you know, one who has all of the answers, all of the antidotes. Then the Dharma itself, which the actual definition is the true spiritual teachings or truth of any particular path. Of course, here, you know, this evening we're talking about Buddhism, but we can view the Dharma as being like the medicine. So the teachings are the actual sort of antidotes, the methods that we can take to really heal our particular sufferings, and all of the difficulties that brings about in our life. And then the Sangha. The Sangha, there are many different levels of Sangha, and generally speaking this means like the Arya Sangha, those people, beings who have realized emptiness, who have realized the highest wisdom, are no longer caught in the cyclic existence. They are experiencing what we call nirvana, or liberation. So they're liberated from the cycle of existence, and this means basically liberated from karma, cause and effect. It's a lot of work to get there, I think. But just to appreciate that that's kind of like the superior Sangha, and then there's the Sangha of the ordained monks and nuns, and then in many centres and teachings that we now say also that the Sangha are like our brother, you know, brother and sister Dharma practitioners. So they are like the nurse helpers, you know, and we know that when the doctor gives us medicine and then we need, you know, or we have an operation, we need help to recover, we need help to really heal. So they're really good people, good beings to hang out with when we're trying to sort of adopt a new practice to really heal in a very deep and profound way. We need the helpers, we need the support, and we need each other, don't we, to be able to do that. We need to be with like-minded people. If we continue to go back into perhaps old circles or hang out with people who perhaps have ways or behaviour that is not really wholesome, then it's very hard for us to really make the genuine and lasting changes. We keep sort of being drawn back. Of course, once we are very strong in our practice and in our own sort of development, it's really important to be with those people and try to support and help them. But until we have some degree of strength and understanding, then we kind of, well, my experience is you just sink back in there as well and start doing all of the undesirable behaviours which you're trying to step away from. So that's just a sort of a little introduction to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And then what is it that we really need to cure? You know, what is this disease? Where is this suffering coming from? And the Buddha taught that basically there are three root poisons, and then all of the other 84,000, I believe, poisons or sufferings or defilements come from these three roots. So the king of them all is ignorance. And this is just not an ignorance of not a worldly kind of ignorance of not being able to understand worldly things, but this is an ignorance that is actually obscuring us from knowing, understanding our true nature and the true nature of all phenomena, all of reality. So it's a big one. And when we have this kind of understanding, we've realised this particular wisdom, then we become like the Arya Sangha, we become free from karma, cause and effect, free from cyclic existence, having to go round and round, experiencing life after life in various suffering ways. So I'm just aware that I'm saying suffering quite a bit, and a lot of people think, gosh, Buddhism's such a depressing religion. All they do is talk about suffering, you know. It must be something else, you know, that's more appealing to the mind and talking about suffering. But, you know, when we don't go to the doctor, do we, if we're really radiantly healthy? We go to the doctor because we're sick. So you know, we have to know, firstly, that we are suffering. And when we stop to look and start to investigate, it's not too hard to realise that actually, of course, we have some pleasure, we have health and we have some happiness in our lives, but it's very temporary, it's very transient, it's always changing. In my experience, the mind is up and down, and so the body goes up and down with the mind. So we're talking here about being able to develop this state that's completely free from the up and down mind. And I don't know about you people, but it's really appealing to me. I'd like to have a mind that just kind of stays in the middle and has this very clear knowing. So the king of them is ignorance, the king of the poisons, and then the second one is attachment, and the third is anger. And we can't have anger, it said, unless we have attachment. So these three are like the three legs of a stool, with the ignorance being the pivotal stool holding it up. So if we can pull that one out, then the attachment and anger have got no basis to function, to be there anymore. However, it's a lot easier, it said, to actually start to reduce and eliminate attachment and anger before it is to realize, you know, the emptiness, or to realize the great wisdom. So where do these poisons exist or abide? So they exist in our mind. They're not out there with the enemy or out there in the difficult circumstances, or out there with anything else that we can think of. And do you note that when things go wrong in your life, how we tend to look outside? We tend to look out there, up there, over there, anywhere but in here. So the Buddha says that's what we've been doing for countless lives. We've been looking out there. We've been roaming around on the outside of ourselves, looking for happiness, looking for the answers, and still we've not found them, because they're not to be found on the outside. They are actually within us. So these root poisons abide within our own mind. And so we say, well, okay, what's the mind? You know, and our Western science, and for a long time, there was no concept, there was no discovery of the mind. No surprise, because it's not something physical. So it can't be found with instruments. It can only be discovered by mind itself. And we're very fortunate that the Buddha actually went through, did all the hard yards, and discovered the nature of the mind, so that he was then able to teach and leave us with very profound teachings, so that we too can discover our mind. So the definition of mind is not so easy, because it isn't something physical. It's not so easy to, we can only describe and use words that say the mind is like this. But each one of us in time has to experience our own mind to really know it. So we can say that in a kind of a sense now, that our mind is the part of us that knows right now where we are, what we're wearing, what we're feeling, what we're hearing, what we're thinking. You know, the mind has this knowing, this cognizing ability. It's not the brain. The brain is something physical. The brain finishes when this body finishes. And according to the teachings of the Buddha, it is the mind, the very subtle aspect of mind, that goes on. So if the mind and brain were the same thing, we would be born here and we would die here. That's it. Sum total, finish. And kind of, it's good to say, well, if that is the case, then what's the purpose of my life? You know, what's it all about? So we have to explore all of the different possibilities. But we'll assume here, we'll go on with the Buddha's teaching, in that we've been born many, many times, countless times, and it is the mind that goes from life to life. So the mind, in its true nature, which we all have, it's not just for a few special people, a few saints and sages and you know, very high teachers. Each one of us has the potential to have this fully developed mind, which is luminous, which is clear, which is spacious, which is genderless, colourless, doesn't have one atom of physicality. So it's like a stream that has this very unique quality of knowing. And it flows from moment to moment, and it changes from moment to moment. I mean, if you sit to really observe your mind, even for 5 minutes, sometimes we can be like, we can be maybe jealous for a couple of minutes, and then it might become angry. Usually anger follows after jealousy. And then we can maybe get over that, and then we might have a period when our mind is a little bit calmer and a little bit perhaps happier. or totally depressed and sad, you know, do you know how your mind changes all of the time? You know, you can get up and think, you know, I'm feeling really good this morning, and then you get a phone call or something happens or an email comes through, and then boom, down goes the mind or up goes the mind. You know, it's always changing. So the real study in Buddhism is our mind. You know, it's not other people's minds. And I know this of myself many times. I'd be sitting in a teaching thinking, oh, gee, I wish so-and-so was here. I wish they were hearing this. You know, then my life would be better. If they could hear this and actually practice it, then I would be happier. It took me a long time to get it, but actually it was my mind that needed to be hearing it, not other people's minds. So we can call this like the inner science, the inner study of actually really coming to our own mind. And of course, the way we do this is through meditation, or one of the ways that we can do it, one of the most powerful and effective ways. So our mind has infinite potential for total development. And I come from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, so I'm not too sure, maybe it's a little different than the Theravadan tradition in perhaps this aspect that the mind that is enlightened is what we all have the potential for. It's a mind that we can say is fully awakened. It is a mind that has every kind of negative quality removed, extinguished, and it is ripened in every positive quality fully, perfectly. So loving kindness, compassion, wisdom, courage, joy, anything positive that we can think of is perfect in the enlightened mind, and it arises spontaneously in all situations with all beings, not just for a few favourites here, but for all living beings everywhere. Wouldn't that be an amazing mind to have? And to know, according to the Buddha, each one of us has that potential to be just like that. That's our full potential. That's the infinite potential of our mind. So everything comes from the mind. Now, our whole life is actually coming from our mind, not from somebody else's mind, not from the government, not from the people out there. It's coming from our own mind. So it's the most powerful thing in the universe. And I remember Lama Yeshe saying that, and I thought, most powerful thing? Ooh, I'm not sure about that. Then he said, you know, it was the human mind that created the nuclear bomb. You know, anything powerful, anything we can point to or know in the universe has actually been developed by mind. It's come from mind, somebody's mind. So that's something quite interesting to chew on, to think about, that it is the most powerful thing in the universe. And it's the mind that is the sole motivator of all of our actions. You know, anything we do, every thought we have, of course, is arising in the mind. The words we speak, the actions I make, even as I sit here, you know, talking with you, you know, all of this is coming from my mind. There's some kind of thoughts that are happening so fast I can't catch them. They're happening so fast that they're causing me to move and express myself in a certain way, just as it is for you, you know, sort of sitting there and doing what you're doing and when you decide to move, etc. So before every action of the body, every word we speak, there's a thought proceeding. It's all driven by the mind. So if we can come to know this, like at first intellectually, and then to really know it, you know, very deeply in a very accurate way, then we realize that our mind is the creator of suffering, our suffering. It's also the creator of our happiness. So this knowing, this amazing discovery, begins to help us to stop blaming others. You know, we've only got to watch the news, pick up a paper, and just to read or hear the stories and how it's always somebody else's fault of why this is happening to me or to those people. Would you agree? There's always somehow something else to blame. The economy, the governments, you know, there's so many things that get a finger pointed at them. But if we can really accept that it is our mind that is creating our life, then we can't actually blame anybody else. We can blame our own delusions, our own defilements. They're the real culprits. That's where we should put the blame, not on external beings or things. Of course, external conditions are a part of the picture. You know, they definitely influence us in certain ways, but they're not the cause, not the cause of our happiness and not the cause of our suffering. So it's only with a thorough understanding of the nature and the potential of our mind that we can actually come to be free from all of the negative emotional states and the delusional states that we all have. And again, I remember in one of the teachings in my early years of Lama Yeshe saying to us, you know, you're all delusional, you're all mentally sick. I thought, wow, you know, myself and many others there, I thought, how rude. We're okay, you know, we're Western, we're all right. And then came to realise not so long after that actually he was incredibly accurate. He was right. You know, it's just a matter of degree as to how mentally sick we are. You know, maybe we're not sick enough to have to be in the institution, but, you know, we're not blissfully mentally clear, are we? We have, you know, because we have this up and down mind and we have delusions, we have ignorance, we have attachment, we have anger, and we have jealousy, we have pride, we have doubt, we have many other negative minds arising. And then we have, of course, all the negative emotional states which really colour our mind and cause us to act in inappropriate ways. You know, whilst we may not mean to harm others, just because we're driven by this uncontrolled mind, the mind that's under the sway of delusions and negative karmic imprints, then we actually engage in actions that do cause harm to others. And of course, if it causes harm to others indirectly, it causes harm to ourselves. So in working with our mind, one of the most fundamental laws that we need to learn about and really need to begin to observe in our life is cause and effect, karma. So karma is a word that wasn't heard too much of in the 60s and 70s, but now, of course, everybody's heard karma. It's in songs, it's in poems, it's everywhere. Probably even children are named karma. It's a very popular word. So karma is a Sanskrit word actually meaning intention. And we can say that it's intention, or maybe, no, the actual translation is action, but it's got this extra action with intention. So everything we do, you know, we generally have some kind of intention. And again, we can come back to that basic sort of wish that we all have is to be happy. Most things that we do, at some level, we're wanting happiness for ourselves. It may not look like it from the external sort of action, but what's driving from the inside is that we're doing these things because somehow we're trying to find a measure of comfort or happiness. So cause and effect is not a law that the Buddha made up. The Buddha merely discovered it and then profoundly realized it and was able to actually explain it in such a way that we can now study and hopefully come to also fully understand it. The Buddha has also said that the topic of karma is incredibly profound, and we can't expect to understand its entire profundity until we're enlightened. So don't worry if you don't get it tonight. It's not a topic that we can fully know until we have a very, very purified and realized mind. What we can begin to get is perhaps the four characteristics of karma, that karma is definite. So what this means is that from a particular action that we commit to, that we engage in with an intention, if our intention is negative, then the result, the effect of that particular action can only be negative. If our intention is positive, the result or the fruit that we reap from that action can only be positive. So we can bring this down to, I think gardening is always a good example. Most of us have done some gardening at some time or have some understanding of gardening, that we can have two packets of seeds, one's carrots, one's tomatoes. and we can prepare the bed well, and we can plant all the carrots and the tomato seeds in the bed. We're going to have a kind of sprinkled garden. It's just going to be a random garden. So what we know is that from the carrot seeds, we're going to get carrots. From the tomato seeds, we're going to get tomatoes. I'm not too sure when genetically modified things come in. Maybe things will change. Maybe the law of karma will change. I don't know. But right now, I think you still get tomatoes from tomato seeds. So there is a potential within that seed. Within the tomato seed, there's the potential for a tomato plant, and then the plant to give fruits, many tomatoes, which also have many little seeds in them. And so the carrot seed has the potential to grow a carrot, which grows beneath the earth, so quite different in its nature. So there's a potency within the seed. So within our mind streams, we have countless seeds. We've got, like, we can think of our mind as being like a garden, a universal garden, and there are just countless seeds in our mind stream. Seeds or imprints, these words are used interchangeably. So how do they get there? You know, where do they come from? And the Buddha taught that these imprints, seeds, come from our very actions. So every thought, word we speak, action we make with our body, with intention, is planting an imprint in our mind stream. An imprint or a seed that remains there until all of the conditions come together for it to ripen and to produce its result. So it's like in the garden, you know, we can put the seeds there, but if we don't water it, we don't have the fertilizer, we don't have enough sunshine, we don't have the right conditions to ripen that particular seed, then the seed just lays there, doesn't it? It stays dormant. But then along comes all of the conditions, then the seed sprouts and germinates and grows. So it's like that with these karmic imprints in our mind stream, that we need all of the conditions to come together. And that's the sum total of our life, that every moment of every day, our karmic imprints are ripening. We're just sort of like, they're ripening and we're creating more because we have this, we're driven with our mind not always being controlled and peaceful, quite often a little bit all over the place. So it's no surprise that we're planting quite a variety of different imprints in our mind stream. And I'm just sort of expressing this now because it's, or explaining it because it's really, it's tied inextricably with the mind. We have to really understand cause and effect if we're going to work with our mind and begin to understand our mind, and then to really integrate the methods into our life. We need to have some understanding of why and how to do that. Okay, so the first characteristic of karma is that karma is definite. The second is that it is dynamic or increases. So I kind of covered that a little bit too when we were saying about the tomato. You know, from one seed we get one tomato plant, but then we get many tomatoes. So one of the characteristics of karma is that it increases exponentially. So we can have just a small imprint, a small negative or positive karma, or we might think it's, oh, that was just a little lie, you know, just a little white lie. It wasn't really anything too heavy. But if we don't purify or at least regret it, then apparently that seed stays in our mind stream and it can increase over time. So just as the one tomato seed can give birth or ripen into many, many, many seeds, then it's like this with the karmic imprint. So this encourages us not by some kind of fear or threat from the Buddha, but by an understanding that even those small negative actions are to be avoided, because they can actually become big things to ripen in a very suffering way. However, it works conversely with the positive karmic imprints, the little actions that we might just think, oh, we just smiled at somebody or just did a little deed. It was only a little positive deed. But don't underestimate its power, because it also increases in your mind stream. So thank goodness it works both ways, not just with the negative. The third characteristic of karma is that it's very specific. And what this means is that we cannot experience a result without having experienced without having created a cause. So this can be quite shocking. Oh, me? No? How come? You know, I'm experiencing this. I've created some cause for this. Surely not. You know, we don't really want to take that responsibility. So it can be a little shocking and frightening at first to think that everything that happens to me at some point in the past, I have created a cause for this. But it's also very liberating, because effectively what it means when we come to terms with it and start to really know it and observe it is that our life is in our hands. It's not in somebody else's hands, it's not in the Buddha's hands, it's not in God's hands, it's not in anybody else's hands. It's actually in our hands. And if we start to really understand the characteristic of karma being specific, and that whatever we experience, we have created the cause for, it really encourages us, gives us probably the best reason to practice mindfulness. So we need to be more and more mindful so that we don't engage in those particular actions that will then create these causes, especially if we get fed up of suffering. And generally that's why most people seem to come to a Buddhist centre or to go to any kind of spiritual path, is because they've had enough of problems in their life. They're looking for a better way. And then the fourth characteristic of karma is that karma is dormant. The imprints lie dormant in the mind. They don't go away unless we experience them. So, of course, they get exhausted, you know, through experiencing. We wear out that particular karma. Or we practice some kind of purification practices, which in some of the traditions of Buddhism, this is greatly emphasised. The main practice of purification when we've done or engaged in some kind of negative action is to generate a very strong and sincere regret. So we really, you know, wish that we hadn't done it, you know, and we regret it. Not feeling guilty. Guilt and regret are quite different. Guilt kind of keeps us stuck. It's like, bad me, poor me, you know, I've done it again. You know, we just get out the whip and just self-flagellate a bit more. So that's not very productive. That's not really compassionate towards yourself. It's a lot healthier. It's a lot more oiling the wheels of being able to purify and move on is to really regret having done something. And then if you can, do some kind of remedial action. So, for example, if we've stolen something, then we would need to practice the opposite. We would need to practice either giving something back to that person or people or company, wherever it might be, or practicing generosity in some way to like counteract that negativity. We can think like this to try and do the opposite action so that we can purify it. And we make some commitment to ourselves. If one is a Buddhist, we say like generally by taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and then making a promise or a commitment that we won't engage in that activity again. If it's something that we're really habituated to doing, then it's wise to not say, I'll never do it again. You might say, I won't do it for the next 5 minutes. Now, you give yourself a realistic length of time that you can actually keep it. And each time you can keep the length of time, then you gradually extend it out so that your mind gets stronger and stronger every time you are able to honour a commitment. If you're not able to honour it, then again you generate regret and you make a lesser time. So this is about being your own therapist, knowing, you know, how to work with your mind, with your particular personality. So that's kind of the basis. We've got a mind, and there's this law, a universal law of karma, cause and effect, which is really how our mind is driven, you know, by this particular law. So how to integrate the Dharma into everyday life? What's most important? And I think you've probably got it by now that we really need to work with our mind. There isn't really any other solution, even though we might have tried many, many things, I'm sure we all have, to find happiness and to find that peace. It still eludes us. So working with our own mind is firstly reading about the mind, taking teachings about the nature of the mind, exploring both from a Western point of view and Eastern point of view, like every point of view, like to really sort of open your mind to the possibilities to do some research. Then if you find that the Buddha's explanation does make some sense for you or fits for you, then of course one of the main practices is meditation. We need to meditate, not to space out, but to really develop both our concentration but also our insight and our wisdom to really grow in understanding. We can develop like a one-pointed concentration, we can get a very sharp mind, But it's like sharpening the kitchen knife and putting it back in the drawer and never cutting the veggies. It's really not much use to us. You know, we've got this amazing tool and we've developed this incredible concentration, which we can all do. You know, again, if we put in the work, we can train it. You know, we can win the gold medal of having a one-pointed concentration. But then to be able to use such a mind to really analyze, you know, understand the teachings, understand, you know, the relevance, you know, to our own mind and how our mind functions or how it doesn't function healthily, then this is skillful. This is, you know, we have to have the teachings to know what the topics are, you know, that we have to really contemplate, you know, impermanence, death and impermanence, precious human life, karma, many, many different topics that will ripen, you know, the right understanding in our mind. So we do a combination of one-pointed concentration, of focusing on the breath, but then also doing what we call analytical meditations to really grow in our wisdom and our understanding. So again, I think in these days, I've never done it, but most other people seem to at some point in time is sign up for a gym to get their bodies into shape. It's amazing the number of things we do for our body in our life. You know, from the time that our mother or carer cares for our body right up until, you know, we die, there's so much happens for the body. But so often, and very sadly, our mind is neglected. And so I think that when we go to a temple, we go to a Dharma centre, we go into a gompa, as the Tibetans call them, a place of meditation, is that we can think of it as like going into a mental gym. So we're actually going to really work with our mind. And this is something really precious and really quite unique and still quite rare, although fortunately meditation is increasing, you know, on the planet, but still a long way to go. So if we never ever cleaned our house, we just lived in it and never ever cleaned it, imagine how it would become. Pretty revolting, eh? So it's like that for our mind. If we never actually stop to pay attention to our mind, never clean it, never, you know, sort of give it some loving and wise attention, it's like it just gets more and more cluttered, more and more chaotic. Do you know this mind? Maybe not. I do. You know, if I don't do something, you know, just like it gets more and more discursive, you know, more and more agitated. So it's like never ever paying attention to cleaning our environment. Is, you know, we have to give our minds some appropriate attention. And then if we never exercised our body, you know, and even just the aging process, you see how things that used to sort of be nice and firm and stay up in the right places begin to sag, begin to sort of, you know, lose their tone. And so if we never do any exercise, you know, what happens to our body? It gets really flabby and unfit, isn't it? So, you know, the same for the mind. If we don't exercise the mind, you know, not just by doing crosswords and things like that, working with computers, but really exercising the mind in a very wise, intelligent way, then our mind is very flabby. You know, we need to take our mind to the mental gym. We need to do meditation. And we can think then, oh, well, maybe I'll go to, you know, Dhamma Loka once a week or once a month or whenever, however often you can come. And that's very good, very, very good that you do that. But what is even better is that you actually do a little bit every day. So if we've got a vessel and we want to fill it with water, if we just put one drop in once a week, it's kind of going to evaporate, isn't it? It's not going to fill up. But if we put a drop in every day, probably in a couple of weeks' time, we have a vessel full of water. So, you know, our mind and meditation is like this too. If we just do a little bit here and there, it doesn't really have such an impact. But if we can do even 5 to 10 minutes every day, at a regular time, this begins to really affect our mind in a positive way. And the effects are accumulative. You know, the more you sort of do it regularly, it's like you get into that routine and then you can really begin to make some progress with your meditation, with proper care for your mind. So many people say to me, how do you fit it in? I said, okay, how do you fit in 10 cups of coffee a day and, you know, 3 meals a day? Do we forget to feed the body? Not usually. I mean, okay, maybe sometimes we get really busy and might suddenly look at the clock and think, oh my gosh, you know, forgot to have lunch or forgot to have something. But generally speaking, we don't forget, do we, to feed the body. But the poor old mind, We just don't have time for that. So rather than thinking of it as being something else that we have to fit in, maybe we can think of, what is it that I could let go of to actually take care of my mind? Seeing it as being something essential rather than as an extra add-on activity in the life, something essential. Do I really want to be happy? We're going to have to ask ourselves that, and ask ourselves not just once but regularly. You know, what am I doing now? Is it really contributing to my happiness, at least to my happiness or to anybody else's happiness? Or am I just kidding myself? You know, do I really want to be happy? What's the bottom line? And only each one of us can answer this for ourselves. And if I do, then how am I going to get that happiness? You know, where will I get it from? I've tried everything, or maybe I've tried many things. Maybe I still have some things on a list that I haven't yet tried. But I'll be surprised if those things actually will bring you the happiness you're looking for. What will bring us the real happiness is to really work with our mind, to understand our mind, to realize its full potential. So in establishing a meditation practice, just want to say very briefly about this, and maybe many of you already have done so, but perhaps there are some who haven't, that it's really good to find a space in your home. Sometimes I say garden, but you know, of course that depends a lot on the weather. So it's actually better if it's in a sheltered place. And to try and dedicate that little place or space to your meditation practice. By putting something nice there, you know, maybe you're not Buddhist, but you might like just to have a nice candle or a nice bunch of flowers or a pot plant or a nice picture, not a busy picture, but a picture that's peaceful for you. Just making that like a very special and sacred space. And then encouraging other family members to feel free to use it, maybe if they want to, but certainly to respect, you know, that it's your space. Because if we keep going to the same space, it kind of builds its energy. Like when I come in here to Dhammaloka, I get the sense that, you know, this is an amazing place, and it has a really beautiful atmosphere, and you come in here and your mind just relaxes. You know, I drove up from Bunbury today, and I sort of had quite a lot to do this afternoon and thinking about tonight's talk, and I walked in here and I just went, oh. Because, you know, the activity that's done here is really supportive for mind development, for really finding the true nature of mind. So we can create a little Dhammaloka in our own homes, in our own, you know, place of abode. But we have to remember to visit it every day, keep it clean, keep it special, and most importantly, to sit there, to be there. And I know for myself, when I was starting out, for the first probably about 5 years, my practice was pretty spasmodic. You know, I got really well for a few weeks and then I'd break it and then I'd start again. And what I did find was that it was really hard getting started again. It was actually a lot easier just to keep going. So people sometimes think, oh, but I can't, you know, I don't have half an hour, I can't do, you know, 7:30 to 8 o'clock meditation. And I think that that's a very valid point, especially when we're trying to introduce something new into our life, into our routine. It is more skillful and generally more successful if we can dedicate 5 to 10 minutes. I often say to people, and I say to the inmates, I say, just the time it takes for you to have a cup of tea or coffee, let that be a meditation. Just skip one drink and sit there and observe your breath or do a meditation. So we're looking at realistically 5 to 10 minutes. And then what happens as you really start to cultivate this habit is that you begin to enjoy it or feel the benefits of it. So before you know it, you're sitting for 15 minutes or 20 minutes, you know, just it kind of grows. And of course that's, you know, up to each person as to how much it grows and what you do with that. But it's an activity that is incredibly beneficial, and I can't think of another activity that will be more beneficial in the long run. So do think about that if you haven't already got a place and a practice, to really try to establish that if you're interested in following this particular path of healing your mind. So having regular contact with a Dharma centre or teacher or other practitioners is also very inspiring, helpful, you know, to be able to support each other in staying on track and doing your practice. Reading inspiring material and One of the key points, I guess, that I've learned through the Tibetan Buddhist tradition is to really be clear about your motivation before any activity, and especially before your meditation, before your spiritual activities, to take a few moments of mindfulness to really think about what is my purpose for doing this activity. So here we're starting to really embrace cause and effect. We're starting to become more aware of our intentions behind our activities. And so it's a really good place to start, like with your meditation, because you know it's a time when you come and you come to sit, so your mind is hopefully beginning to quieten, and you can really generate a strong motivation that this be something that is really beneficial for you, and if it's beneficial for you, it's going to be beneficial for others. So I mean, so many of the great teachers constantly remind us that world peace can only come about from each individual having peace within their own mind. So every time we sit to even have 1 or 2 minutes of peace, you know, we can think of that as being a major and a valuable contribution to world peace, to all of our brothers and sisters, fellow man everywhere. So taking care of the mind and then observing karma when the bad things happen to us, to not freak out, to not point the finger of blame, but to think, okay, somewhere in my past, you know, I have created the cause for this. Let me learn from this particular situation. Let me really feel and know the suffering in a way that will inspire me, help me to not do this again and again, to not create the causes. So because we can say that generally the effect is similar to the cause, if we're experiencing a particular effect, we can think, well, the cause is probably this, you know, like if I'm experiencing some kind of like shortness to my life, it usually means that we've shortened the lives of others, which usually means killing. So, you know, it's not too hard to work out, you know, when certain things happen to us at all. Maybe that's something that I really have to be more mindful of and certainly not to engage in. So observing karma is a very important part in integrating Dharma into our everyday life. Then in our everyday activities, at the beginning of the day, this is an excellent time to wake up and not follow ego to the kitchen, to the cup of coffee, to the cup of tea, whatever else it might want to do immediately upon awakening, but to actually take a moment, whether you're laying down or when you first sit up or stand up, to think how amazing I've actually woken up and I'm still in my human body this morning. And this might sound like, well, of course, you know, I'm always going to wake up in my human body. But hey, one day, we're not going to wake up. Well, maybe we're not going to die in our sleep, but we're not going to have the opportunity to wake up again to have another day in our human life. And another day in our human body means another day to actually get closer to happiness if we're working with the teachings and to really integrate the Dharma into our everyday life. So it's really good to think how amazing, because I've woken up, but there will be many on this planet that didn't wake up in the body that they went to bed in. We know this, and people die in their sleep, they die in all kinds of ways, you know, and we can think that throughout the day, but it's just kind of good when we wake up to, it's like we wake up to a new life, we wake up to a new day, and how wonderful I'm still in my human body. So therefore we stop to think about our motivation for the day. And I've had many people share, and I know this for myself, that if I just, what I do, it's a practice now to take the time to really set the motivation, how it can influence your day, to really think about what's important for me in this day, you know, and if it's important for me, may it be important for others. So we really take that time to sort of generate a good motivation for the day ahead, instead of just getting up and thinking, oh, here we go again, you know, the humdrum of life, you know. Hey, we've got an amazing life, you know, we're human beings with a sophisticated central nervous system, you know, we can do so much with our minds, and we already do so much, don't we? But we can do so many skillful things, and that's, I guess, with the practice of Dharma, what we're endeavouring to do. So then when we're bathing, you know, showering, whatever we do in the morning, we can think also, you know, that we can transform all of these mundane activities into sacred or Dharma activities by thinking, as I shower, as I wash, may I wash away all the defilements, may I wash away all of the faults, you know, anything that I said or did yesterday or in the past, you know, that I'm aware of, I can remember, may it just all flush down the drain pipe, never to be seen again. So it might sound a bit strange, but it's amazingly powerful when we start to think about our ordinary everyday activities. We start to find a new joy and a new delight in them. And when our mind is joyful and, you know, more delighted, then we've got more energy, we're more vibrant, we're happier, aren't we? I mean, that's the basic thing, is that we do experience an increasing degree of happiness. So when we're washing the dishes, instead of thinking, oh, here, I've got to wash the dishes again, you know, poor me. You know, how does our mind normally think? Wow, how amazing, I can clear away all the defilements, you know, clear away the anger and clear away the jealousy and, you know, really think about what is it that's in my mind that's really poisoning my mind, is obscuring my mind. Let those everyday activities, you know, sweeping the floor, vacuuming, cleaning the toilet, whatever it is, you know, think of it as cleaning. And then when you're cooking, think, you know, how fortunate I am actually to have this food to cook. And then if I'm cooking for others, you know, may I always be able to cook really nourishing food for others. Nourishing in a spiritual sense, nourishing that they can, you know, maintain good, healthy physical life, but also a good, healthy mental life. And that all of the beings everywhere who don't have food, may they somehow, you know, be able to have the, you know, create the causes to have food. So many ways we can think to bring the Dharma into our everyday actions. And this makes or helps our everyday life to take on a very different meaning, become so much more purposeful. And then as we come towards the end of the day, which I think we're almost at 9 o'clock, so we'll come towards the end of the day very quickly. We've gone through the day, you know, been very mindful, and we've now come to the end of the day, to this activity that we tend to spend a lot of time doing, sleeping. Unless, of course, you experience insomnia, and I know many people do. But speaking generally, and we spend many hours in sleep. And I actually came across some statistics, which I didn't bring with me, but this is quite some time ago, and I was giving a talk, and I got quite a shock to see how much of our life we actually spend asleep. It was rather a lot, quite frightening. So we can make even sleep a spiritual activity. So what is good to do is just to have a little quiet time, just to do a very brief reflection through the day. How did I go? You know, was I mindful? You know, were there actions that I wished I hadn't have done? And, you know, just sort of where did it come from? Just do a little reflection. And then remember to regret the negative actions, but also to rejoice in the good actions. I think sometimes we get really lopsided. We're really down on ourselves. We forget to actually rejoice and be really happy and joyful about the good things we did, because I'm sure that, you know, the whole day wasn't bad. We always do good things as well, so to really take time to rejoice and think, oh, how wonderful that I was able to do that. You know, this is not an egotistic kind of thought. This is actually really encouraging your mind to want to go down the good paths. And then when we do go to sleep, we can think along the lines again of setting a motivation to sleep. That may I sleep now to renew my energy, to support good physical and mental health, so that I can wake up in my precious human body again and have another meaningful day. You know, something like that, but to be fresh, to be able to do my work well, to be able to serve my family well, whatever it might be. So we generate this motivation, and then, as our teachers say, then you can sleep for many hours, and every hour you're sleeping, you're creating good merit or good karmic imprints, because you've motivated to sleep with that particular superior motivation, rather than just grasping at more darkness to be asleep. So just a couple of little things to finish off with, that the Buddha said that when we are alone, it's really important to observe our mind. And when we're with others, it's really important to observe our speech. So try to remember that as also being a very important aspect of the teachings to take into our everyday life. When you're on your own, observe your mind. When you're with others, observe your speech. And finally, a quote from my own teacher, Lama Yeshe: be mindful of all your actions and keep your motivation as pure as possible. In this way, you will reach your goal naturally. So there's no forcing and there's no pushing. It will come if we can do the right thing each and every day with the right motivation. So thank you. And I don't know if that generated any questions at all, but I think normally we have a few minutes for questions if there are any. What did I mean by that? Well, that I met my own teacher, that I knew that they were my teachers. And then other people, I meet many people who are going from country to country, centre to centre, teacher to teacher, saying they're still looking for like their heart teacher. It doesn't mean that they don't take teachings from these teachers, but they're actually looking for the teacher that we call the root teacher or the heart teacher. And this person is described as being the one that turns your mind towards the Dharma or turns your mind towards the spiritual path in the most powerful and profound way. Does that answer your question? Yeah? Thank you.
How does consciousness fit in the picture? In Buddhism, everything is mind, everything is mind, everybody's mind. But how does consciousness fit in the picture?
Yeah. Consciousness is a word for mind. Means the same thing. So when I keep saying mind, you can keep saying consciousness. It's good. Thank you.
Yeah, over here. Yes. The saying was pretty obvious that attachment leads to suffering.
Yes.
How do you have children and marriage? And
in 2 minutes. Right. That's a big question, and it's a very good one. In a nutshell, what we have, generally speaking, as an ordinary person, and that's all I am, we have love and attachment. It's mixed. And of course, while we're ordinary people, it's going to be that way. So it doesn't mean that in order to give up attachment, we give up our wife, our husbands, our children, our family. I mean, some people choose to do that for all kinds of reasons, not necessarily a spiritual reason. But what we can do is to stay in the relationships and to continually work on our mind and on our levels of attachment. It's not easy to do, but these are, remember, the three root poisons, ignorance, attachment and anger. So they're the very big ones. There are many other things that we can work to reduce and eliminate before these big ones. With attachment and love, the main sort of, maybe I can just offer a definition here that will perhaps give you something to think about and hopefully work with, is that attachment is our own mind needing, you know, we're always needing something, someone, something, and in every situation we always have an expectation of there's something in it for me. When we have a genuine love for another person, for our children, partner, whoever, then it's more about wishing for that person to be happy and to always create the causes for happiness. So if, for example, that person was abusing us one day and we had love for them, we wouldn't be upset by that. We would still wish for them to be happy. If we have attachment, then we'll get really unhappy because they're not pleasing us in the way that our attachment wants to be pleased. If we, yeah, I guess that's probably just one example of when we have the mind driven by attachment, is that we are always needy, and while the other person is doing what pleases us, then we love them. But when they stop doing what pleases us and actually even start to harm us, then the love, I mean, the, yeah, what we call love turns into sometimes hatred and anger. Does that give you something to think? It's a very big topic, and I would really encourage you to research it and to take teachings. Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
You said something about everything in the universe being created by.
In terms of the environment, Okay, so when we talk about karma, the Buddha talks about collective karma. So we can say that right now the environment that we're experiencing, the degeneration of or whatever, is like a collective karma, that all of the beings that are living here now, it's like our minds have actually created this particular environment as a collective karma. So in past times we have created same causes to be able to experience this particular environment. It's a big thing to try and explain, but whenever we have a group of people, beings, or just say people, experiencing what appears on the outside the same thing, of course the way we experience it individually can be quite different, but we are all in a sense experiencing global warming or whatever we're experiencing, we have a collective karma, so it's our minds that have actually created that collectively. Oh, okay. Sorry. right. That's a big one too. So when science talks about the Big Bang, the Buddha says no problem. It's just that it wasn't the first Big Bang. So we can say, well, who created the universe if it wasn't mind? We can ask ourselves that and explore that particular thinking. If it's not a mind, if there's a creator, does the creator have a mind? It's not. Is there a God? Is there an external being that creates? That is something different from mind? I leave you with a question. Yeah. Thank you. Yes. Sure. Okay. It looks like they're the same, doesn't it, at times, most of the time. My ego, my mind, same thing. The explanation goes that ego is this sense of I that is inherently existing from its own side, that your I and my I are something like stand alone, not dependent upon the body and mind. If we really search for that I, and I'm using I now as being interchangeable with the word ego, this I that arises so strongly when I get criticized or praised or whatever, angry, you know, that it's I wants to have the last word, etc. This I is the one that doesn't exist. So this is the ego. And this is tied in with the ignorance that I talked about earlier that's intrinsic in every mind. But can be removed. So it's not a permanent part of the mind, but it's completely obscuring us. So that sense of I is part of this ignorance, that sense of ego is part of this ignorance. Okay? So it looks like it exists as something like separate from the body and mind, but if we were to sit here and actually go through our body and our mind looking for that I, well, I've never been able to find one. And my teachers haven't yet either. So they keep saying, look, just, you keep looking, you keep, you know, is it outside, is it inside? And you find actually that it's kind of elusive. So this is ego. But it's riding, like it's riding on the gross level of the mind. So in that way it's connected to the mind, but it's not a permanent findable thing. Its purpose, it's the functioning of ignorance. Does it really have a purpose? Not really. It's just that it's there as like a layer, as an obscuration. But we can remove it. That's the good news. Yeah.
Do you think that stems from the brain?
From the brain? No, not from the brain. No, from the mind, from the gross level of mind. Yeah. Yeah. Brain is like our computer for the mind to function through. But it's not the actual mind itself. Because brain is physical, mind is non-physical, according to the Buddha's teachings. Yeah. So maybe...
You stimulated a lot of questions.
I didn't allow enough time.
It's well on 10 past 9, so maybe we can say thank you very much, and if people still have other big questions, maybe they could queue up.
Sure.
We'll just have to have you back next year.